Lisboa,
Bruxelles,
Warszawa.
This podcast has been produced in cooperation with Euronet Plus, the leading radio network for EU news.
But this podcast would not be possible without the incredibly generous support of our amazing listeners who donate a little bit each month at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. Hello and welcome to The Europeans, the podcast once described by The Observer as providing a buoyant take on European life. I'm Dominic Kramer, tuning in from Amsterdam, and I'm speaking to Wojciech Oleksiak in Warsaw. Hi, Wojciech.
Hi, hello. How are you doing?
Yeah, well, I have to admit, I'm not sure how buoyant I'm feeling this week. More like a kind of half-deflated balloon, if I'm honest. How about you?
Yeah, same. You know, there's been better weeks, but we have to keep on keeping on, right?
Yeah, I guess so. It just feels like the proto-fascists have won this round, but we've got to pick ourselves up, regroup, and find some new arguments and new methods to beat these fascistic forces, right?
Yeah, exactly. It feels like we're doing this every Monday, so yeah, let's keep on keeping on.
Yeah, let's. How's your week been?
My week's been very, very busy, but I wasn't the busiest being on this planet because I got to visit an apiary.
An apiary is a place with bees, right?
Yeah, I just learned a minute ago. You know, I visited a place where there are a lot of beehives, and there was this wonderful beekeeper, Mr. Tadeusz, who like gave me a tour, and he told me how the bees are working. He showed me everything. He got even stung by a bee, which I thought doesn't happen so often to beekeepers, right? I mean, you know, if I was stung, that would be obvious, but he got stung. So it was very, very nice to see that, you know, nature has its own cogs and it's working despite everything going on around us. And it was very optimistic in kind of a gloomy week that also left me a bit deflated.
Well, that sounds wonderful. I want to go to an apiary.
I can drive you there if you come to Poland.
Okay, deal.
Very nice place.
So yeah, it's been a gloomy week, but I promise this episode isn't going to be all doom and proto-fascism. In fact, we've got something rather uplifting coming your way. A conversation with Johanna Fabrin from 21st Europe, a woman who spends her days dreaming up bold, exciting, optimistic ideas for Europe's future. If ever there was a week we could use a shot of hope, this is it. That's later in the show, but first, it's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week, bad week.
Well, let's start with Bad Week. I think that feels appropriate this week. Who are you giving Bad Week to, Wojciech?
Well, my dear friend, I'm afraid we all had a bad week. I'd say Europe and the entire Western world had a bad week for failing to respond effectively to Russia's another provocation. Obviously, I mean specifically the last week's drone incursion into NATO airspace.
Yeah, it's been a scary week. For me, I kind of felt like it came a bit sooner than I was expecting, this kind of action.
Right.
How would you describe the mood in the eastern part of Europe right now?
Well, I'm not going to lie. It was really, really tense last week and throughout the weekend too. It seemed to have loosened up a bit over the last couple of days, but still I can't remember a time when everyone was so on edge. I don't know, like since February 2022 or something. So, you know, the time when Russia launched their full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
I know this story was all over the news, so maybe we don't need to recap every detail, but perhaps you can tell us how it looked from your perspective living in Poland. I think you happened to be right at the border when it happened, right?
Yeah, that's true. So I was on the Polish-Belarusian border at the time working on one of my long-term investigative projects, and I woke up on Thursday and saw several messages on my phone. The first one I opened was from my brother. It read, "What a nice wake-up call, huh?" So I was like, no, that gave me a bit of an adrenaline rush because I knew massive military exercises were happening on the other side of the border. Russia and Belarus, they run this Zapad exercise. Zapad is West in Russian. So in 2022, these exercises pretty fluently transitioned into the invasion of Ukraine. So there was some tension beforehand. So, you know, I opened up the news sites and realized what was happening. And at first it was very vague. Some drones had crossed from Ukraine to Poland and that was that.
And did you spend the next several hours glued to Twitter or Blue Sky doom scrolling?
I wish I could. Also, it's funny, every time there is like some unrest on the border, I go to Twitter that I never use except for that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I had to work intensely. So just, you know, every time I had a break, I logged in immediately to see the latest updates. And quite early, the Prime Minister's office officially confirmed that 19 to 23 drones, Russian drones, had flown into Poland's airspace. The ones that posed a threat were shot down by Polish and NATO air defense and jet fighters. No casualties, no follow-up attacks. So that was some sort of a good news.
And it seemed pretty certain, like immediately, that this was deliberate, right? Not an error.
Yeah, you know, obviously there was a massive debate in the internet. All the OSINT experts started just discussing the thing. But the way I was convinced that this is actually, you know, a deliberate attack was by analyzing flight patterns. We know flight routes of Russian drones that aim at hitting targets in Ukraine. These drones, however, the one that attacked Polish airspace, they flew over vast empty spaces in Ukraine, avoiding their air defense and clearly heading into Poland from the get-go. Also, some of them were launched from Belarus, so they directly flew into Poland's airspace.
Okay, that sounds pretty clear.
You know, so the next thing I wanted to know is what the USA / NATO reaction to this would be, because this was a first, right? Russia very blatantly and deliberately violated the airspace of a NATO country. So first thing I saw was this tweet from the Orange Man that read, "What's with Russia violating Poland's airspace with drones? Here we go." I have no idea what this "here we go" was supposed to mean. And then 20 hours later, Trump finally spoke out and said,
Could have been a mistake. But regardless, I'm not happy about anything having to do with that whole situation. But hopefully it's going to come to an end.
And later that day, we learned that J.D. Vance was apparently born yesterday.
We could have a very productive economic relationship with both Russia and Ukraine in the future. And frankly, Matt, if we had a better relationship economically in Eastern Europe, in that region of the world, it might actually be the best guarantee of a long-term peace. Because once you've got good economic relationships with people, you don't want to blow that stuff up quite literally by restarting a war.
Yeah, so basically he just summarized the European strategy of appeasing Russia post-2014 and the annexation of Crimea, which, as we know, resulted in Russia understanding that they could do whatever they want. And, you know, 8 years later, they launched a full-scale invasion. So I'm really afraid this is not going to work this time. Mr. Vance?
I'm not sure you saw it, but on Monday, Trump acknowledged that his attempt at striking a peace deal with Putin is nothing but a failure so far.
Yeah, I was so surprised he admitted that. But I was also kind of, you know, pleased he did that on camera, because at least he stopped pretending he doesn't see how wrong he is about Putin. Since their negotiation in Alaska and the red carpet, Putin has ordered record number of drone strikes against Ukraine. He disrupted peace talks. He's gone so blatant as to invite Zelensky to Moscow. He visited China and talked about wanting to live for 150 years. And now he sent drones to strike Poland and fly over Romania. All he wants is further escalation. And anyone who saw his list of demands in Alaska should understand that in no time. I don't have high expectations for Trump's administration to react to such provocations in a decisive way, but what they did this past week was a total failure, I think.
Has the European response given you a bit more hope?
Yes, of course. You can guess who answered in a way that I loved the most.
Is it your favorite European politician, Kaya Kallas?
Of course it was.
The EU's High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy.
Yeah, so the person with the longest title in the whole EU, she said, "We have witnessed the most serious violation of European airspace by Russia since the beginning of the war. There is reason to believe this was deliberate, not accidental. Russia's war is escalating, not ending."
Wojciech smiling, everyone. You're a big fan, yeah.
Yeah, I'm a big fan still. Nothing has changed. But also Mark Rutte, the Netherlands' former prime minister and now NATO's secretary general, said NATO will launch the Eastern Sentinel program to strengthen the defense of Europe's eastern flank. He also added something that I think should be stressed more often.
Well, generally speaking, you know, I don't like that whole eastern flank thinking because it gives the impression that if I live in Madrid or in London, I'm safer than when I live in Tallinn. And that is not true. Because these latest Russian missiles, when they will be launched, they come down with 5 times the speed of sound, and they will take 5 or 10 minutes longer to reach Madrid or London than they take to reach Tallinn or Vilnius. So in that sense, let's agree that within this alliance of 32 countries, we all live on the eastern flank.
And more or less by that time, I was back in Warsaw and saw a barrage of really unsettling news. First, a video of a Russian truck carrying an Iskander ballistic missile was posted, reportedly only a few kilometers from the Polish border. It was soon confirmed by geolocation experts to be on a highway in Kaliningradskaya Oblast, some 35 kilometers from the border.
What could be in a rocket like that?
Almost anything, including nuclear warheads. It has a reach of at least 500 kilometers, so from there it could strike all of Poland and beyond. And you know, then there was an air raid in Lublin. It turned out to be a false alarm, but authorities suspected more drones were in Polish airspace. Airports were immediately shut down and some airspaces across the region were closed, also in Estonia and Latvia.
This all doesn't sound relaxing at all.
No, and you know, it all builds into this heavy, ominous atmosphere. I want to tell you a little story quick. This past Saturday, I was doing groceries in the supermarket when the loudspeakers announced that car payments were temporarily unavailable. Normally, people would just frown and wait, but here it created a lot of tension among customers, like immediately. People started gossiping, suspecting it was a Russian cyber attack. You know, they started leaving their carts half-packed and walking out. It looked really chaotic. You know, I immediately went online and discovered that card payments were down across the entire country. I was like, huh, interesting. I had my card full, so I went to the nearest cash machine and there was already a queue of at least 10 people nervously pulling out big sums of money. You know, it just looked like the war was just about to start. The service resumed after an hour or so, and at least so far the problem is believed to have resulted from a technical failure. But I mean, you see the point. This is how Russia wins with us every day, by instilling this idea in all of us that they're coming sooner or later. You know, maybe today, maybe in 5 years, we just don't know. And with all these drones and rockets and closed airspaces and airports and borders, I wasn't surprised. Elderly ladies around me were 100% convinced we should be looking for the nearest shelter. You know, it was, I mean, I'm not a person that panics easily, but it was really dark. You know, it was just like my darkest little hour ever.
The darkest of all your hours in Lidl. Oh, Wojciech.
Yeah, and I've had a lot of dark hours in Lidl.
Oh, God. What do you think Russia is actually trying to achieve with this drone attack? Do you think it is just that, to like sow chaos and fear in NATO and the EU and EU citizens doing their supermarket shopping?
First of all, I have no idea what Russia is planning, and I don't think anyone has. If someone tells you they have, I think they're probably daydreaming. I'm sure it's nothing good for Europeans, though. You know, the military experts I've been following for years say it was indeed a test on how NATO would react to such an interference, how radars over Poland and Romania work, what type of equipment would be used in the first place. So we can call it a minor reconnaissance attack. I think that's the right, you know, military term, probably having something to do with these Zapad exercises I mentioned earlier.
How was the reaction? Like, how did NATO, Poland, the EU come out of this? Did they react quick enough?
You know, it's very hard to tell. Now there is a big debate over whether the reaction was, you know, blown out of proportion, whether that was accurate, how much money we spent because we launched some rockets that were worth like 2 million euro to shut down a drone that was worth 10,000 euro. I think the reaction was pretty quick. No one got harmed. I see a lot of criticism, you know, and a lot of remarks that Poland air defense system is not ready for this and that we should really ramp up our efforts to get better. But on the other hand, you know, something that kind of felt good to us is that NATO forces, especially Dutch forces in collaboration with Polish forces, they reacted really quickly. You know, they noticed this way ahead of those drones incoming. They managed to shut down the ones they thought posed threats. So I guess it's kind of good. But obviously, you know, there's probably a long, long way to go to learn from Ukrainians how to deal with drones. Actually, they are, you know, specifically the one army that has the most knowledge about that. And from what I learned, there are quite simple methods and you can use quite low-key equipment to shut down drones very effectively.
And now there's a discussion, obviously, about how Europe and NATO should be reacting going forward. What are some of the ideas about what should be done now?
You know, I'm convinced that further attempts to de-escalate are the worst strategy possible. This is exactly what Russia and Putin want. Kaya Kallas, again, my favorite European politician, she summarized it perfectly. And she said that, you know, quote, talks of surrendering Ukraine territories are a trap set by Putin, end quote. You probably noticed that in their peace proposal laid out in Alaska, they wanted, among other things, full control over Donbas. They never conquered it, never owned it. And by accepting such offers, and we can hear voices calling for Ukraine's capitulation across Europe, this is exactly what allows Russia to act with impunity, just like we let them off the hook way too easily with Crimea.
So, do you think Europe should be preparing for a war with Russia?
Well, I think we have to accept the fact that we are already, you know, in a state of a very, very active conflict with Russia. Maybe it's not a war. Maybe for most of Europe, it will never be a full-on war. But for that not to happen, it's time to show our strength and resolve, both at the negotiation table and in supporting Ukraine. And that should translate to stopping the purchase of Russian resources as quickly as possible. Obviously, most apparently, Slovakian and Hungarian governments are siding with Russia and Turkey is beyond our control. But, you know, some seemingly very anti-Russian EU countries are still buying resources from Russia and in mass quantities. And this just has to stop. If we continue feeding them with our money, they will never stop. Let's start with cutting them off our money. Let's try to derail their alliances with India, China, Belarus. And if they attack, let's not discuss if it was intentional or not for the first 48 hours, but let's act firmly, decisively, and together.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like you've got a plan. Ring up Kaya.
Yeah, Kaya. She's not picking up. I'm trying to, you know, yeah, ask her to
leave
do
Kaya alone, Wojciech.
I'm not calling that often.
Do you have a sense of what's next for the Russian-European tensions on the eastern border?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. After 2022, I refuse to predict anything. Yeah, what I can do is I can leave you with a quote from our former guest and the current president of Finland, Alexander Stubb, who gave a very interesting interview to Bloomberg last week.
Right now, we're living in a 1918, 1945 or 1989 moment in world history. And now we're in a similar situation. We just don't know where the world is going to go.
I highly recommend you listen to the entirety of this interview. I'll post a link in the show notes. So leaving you on that very high note, and cheerful note, Dominic, who has had a good week? I'm really eager to listen about something positive now.
Well, good week. This is the segment of the show this week that's made in cooperation with our partners at Euronet Plus. And now it feels wrong to call anything connected to Israel and Gaza a good week. There's really nothing good about what's happening there, especially this week as we've seen the ground incursion of Gaza City launched. But I'm giving a very tentative, heavily caveated good week to the EU for some signs that the institutions might be finally moving towards putting pressure on Israel. So these signs emerged last week on Wednesday during Ursula von der Leyen's State of the Union address. That's the moment of the year when the president of the European Commission gives a big speech to the European Parliament, where she looks back at the past year and looks ahead at what the Commission's challenges and priorities will be in the year ahead. And for the first time, she actually sounded like she had a bit of a plan to place some pressure on Israel.
Honourable members, what is happening in Gaza has shaken the conscience of the world. People killed while begging for food, mothers holding lifeless babies, These images are simply catastrophic. So I want to start with a very clear message. Man-made famine can never be a weapon of war for the sake of the children, for the sake of humanity. This must stop.
Great. I'm really happy you're going to fill me in on that because I couldn't, you know, spend enough time on this. So please tell me, what is she actually proposing?
Well, she proposed a few things. She wants to suspend bilateral support for Israel. So that would hit Israel financially in various different areas. She called for the partial suspension of the EU-Israel Association Agreement on Trade. Remember that the EU is Israel's biggest trading partner, making up 32% of Israel's trade. So this could have a big effect on the Israeli economy if it happens. And she also proposed sanctions against extremist ministers and violent settlers, as various EU countries have already done so.
That's a very promising set. And what do you think, what chances there that any of this will actually happen?
Well, I should say that we're recording this on Tuesday, but it looks like the European Commission is going to move ahead with von der Leyen's trade-related proposals, which would mean reimposing duties on Israeli goods. The European Parliament voted on Thursday in support of most of what von der Leyen had proposed. The text in the Parliament was watered down in a compromise that was made in order to secure the votes of the centre-right European People's Party. They took out the statement about man-made famine and also took out the statements that criticised the EU Commission and EU governments for their inaction. But the compromise meant it passed. 305 in favour, 151 against, 122 abstentions. Though most members of the European Parliament voted against an amendment from the left grouping that would have described Israel's actions in Gaza as a genocide. That's apparently still a bridge too far for a majority of this European Parliament. And yeah, that's perhaps not so surprising considering how right-wing the current European Parliament is. But I think it's important to be clear that the dial has shifted in the European Commission and in the Parliament, at least in terms of rhetoric. But in order for there to be any real world changes, these proposals that von der Leyen brought forward will have to be agreed on by the EU Council. Now, Wojciech, do you remember what the EU Council is?
Of course I do.
Of course you do. It's the part of the EU that is made up of the heads of state or government of the 27 EU countries.
Yeah, it's also very hard to get anything through the EU Council, right?
Yeah, mainly because on most issues it requires the leaders of EU countries coming to a unanimous standpoint, something that is difficult to achieve on anything, frankly, but particularly difficult when it comes to punishing Israel for its war crimes, especially when you have leaders like Hungary's Viktor Orban or Italy's Giorgia Meloni, who are still very strongly aligned to Netanyahu. That said, the partial suspension of the EU-Israel Association Agreement on Trade would only need a qualified majority of the EU Council. That's the thing that Sven mentioned on our podcast 2 weeks ago, when something needs to be supported by at least 55% of member states, representing at least 65% of the EU's population. So the trade suspension could actually be a bit more likely to pass. But even getting a qualified majority on this is nowhere near certain. I actually got in touch with the press officer at the EU Council to find out like when this would be happening, and they didn't know. So it's clearly not happening imminently. But yeah, the fact that it is now being proposed by the European Commission is a shift.
I have to say I'm very pleased, because what you're saying now feels as if Ursula von der Leyen just listened to our episode from 2 weeks ago titled "Why is the EU not acting on Gaza?" and like, as if she took notes and decided to act accordingly.
I think that's exactly what happened, Wojciech. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, right. So if it wasn't that, by some very weird coincidence, do you know what else could have pushed her to act a bit more strongly?
Well, maybe she is looking at the news coming out of Gaza each day and has finally realized, rather belatedly, that this cannot go on. Maybe she actually agrees with the assertion that what we're seeing in Gaza is a genocide and we shouldn't be trading with a country that's committing war crimes. In fact, that EU-Israel trade agreement has an article, Article 2, that states that respect for human rights is an essential element of this agreement. But honestly, this announcement from von der Leyen, even if many people think it comes way too late and doesn't go far enough, it did surprise a lot of EU observers. There is not yet a consensus amongst EU leaders to suspend this agreement. So she's actually getting out there ahead of the pack and trying to make this happen. And that's especially surprising when you think about her political background. She's a Christian Democratic German politician from the European People's Party, a background that doesn't exactly make her the obvious person to push the EU to get tough on Israel.
To say the least.
Yeah. But your question was why she has changed her stance, right?
Yeah, 2 years into that.
Yeah, and I guess the cynical answer is that she needs the support of centrist and centre-left parties in order to keep her political coalition together and in order to stay in power. And many in the centre and centre-left have become increasingly exasperated by the EU's lack of action on Gaza. So, yeah, she had to give them a reason to keep supporting her, and maybe that is what this is.
That would be a bit pragmatic of her, but yeah, I could see that being the case. So I wonder what our guest from 2 weeks ago would think about this shift from von der Leyen.
Well, I actually have read what Shada Islam thinks about it. She was the Brussels-based commentator who spoke to us 2 weeks ago. She's actually just launched a really good Substack called Simply Shada. Go and subscribe. And she described the State of the Union as a meek but significant first step by a woman who has remained loyally aligned with the Israeli government, even as Israel has carried out its genocidal onslaught in Gaza, violently evicted more Palestinians from their homes in the West Bank, and extended its aggression by bombing Qatar and other states.
Meek but significant. I love Shada. She's so brilliant. It's a really good way of putting it.
Yeah, indeed, it is. Maybe we should rename this section from Good Week to Meekly Significant Week.
Meek Week, does it make sense?
Yeah, it kind of does. I should also mention that this move from von der Leyen isn't the only sign from the past week that some parts of Europe are starting to get tougher on Israel. For example, Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez announced a raft of measures, including formalizing the de facto weapons embargo to, quote, stop the genocide in Gaza and to go after its perpetrators. He also said this week that he thought Israel should be shut out of sports competitions, just like Russia was after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. He said, while barbarism persists, Israel cannot use international events to whitewash its presence. And now it's not just sport events, but also cultural events.
Oh, I know what's coming. I know what's coming.
One that has been creating a lot of headlines this week is the question of whether or not Israel will be allowed to compete in Eurovision next year. Yeah, sorry, I take any excuse to talk about Eurovision. I realize it may not be the most important thing in this whole horrible war, but there's been a lot of news about Eurovision and Israel this week. A few broadcasters said over the past week or so that they would not take part in Eurovision if Israel is a participant. At the time of recording, that's the broadcasters from the Netherlands, from Ireland, from Iceland, from Slovenia, and from Spain. And on top of those countries, Belgium and Finland are also looking increasingly unlikely to join if Israel is allowed to take part. So, yeah, there are definitely some shifts happening when it comes to how Israel is being treated in Europe. I guess we'll have to wait and see if any of these proposals and rhetorical shifts turn into real action. But for now, Good Week, or what was it? Meek Week.
Meek Week.
Significantly Meek Week goes tentatively to the signs of a shift in Europe's response to Gaza. Time for the part in the show where we thank the wonderful people who have given us support over the past week.
Yes, welcome to the begging segment. This is your chief beggar, Wojciech Oleksiak.
Thanking and begging, yes.
Yes, thanking and begging segment. So as we remind you every week, this show depends entirely on your support to keep going long term. Right now, we're very fortunate to be a part of a grant that helps stabilize and grow our operations, but it only lasts until the end of 2026. After that, we'll need to ride without training wheels. In our carefully thought out strategy, the core of our future funding is supposed to come from you, our listeners. And you know what? A month ago, I shared my concern about stagnating subscriber growth. And do you know what happened? A lot of people responded to our call. I want to say a huge thank you to everyone who did. We really deeply appreciate it. It seems we're on a much better path than a month ago. We gained more than 40 new subscribers in just last month. And if we keep this momentum going, we'll be very close to reaching our target in 16 months. So if this podcast is dear to you and you'd like to see it survive and grow and keep bringing you news and analysis with expertise, humor, and a sense of familiarity, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/European podcast. You can subscribe for as little as €3 a month or head to our website, europeanpodcast.com, to make a one-time donation. Every contribution helps.
Yes, we have a few wonderful new people to thank this week. Thank you to Clara, Christina, Robert, Ivan C., Sabina, and also to Marine and Georgia for increasing their pledges.
That's, again, a very long list, so thank you, thank you, thank you. I'll keep reporting on how it's going, and I'll keep inventing new metaphors for us being forced to fly on our own in 16 months. I take a lot of fun in that, so I'm really sure we'll make it work by January 2027. Thank you.
So it's time to speak to this week's guest. And today, you'll be pleased to hear, we're going to be talking about dreamy futures of Europe. Our guest is Johanna Fabrin, who is one of the managing directors of a new think tank called 21st Europe. They work on imagining projects that could improve this continent that we call home. Honestly, right now, with all the many global crises, it feels like this is something we could easily forget to do. So I'm very pleased that Johanna agreed to speak to us today and to talk about some of the blueprints they're dreaming up for Europe and to talk about why they're doing all this dreaming. Hi, Johanna. Thanks so much for joining us today. We're here to talk because you're the managing director of a think tank, 21st Europe, but I get the impression that what you're doing is a bit different from what people usually expect from a think tank. Can you explain what it is that you're trying to do at 21st Europe?
Yeah, hi, Dominic. Thanks so much. It's exciting to be here. And I think that's a great question. And we call ourselves a think tank maybe because there isn't really another name for what it is that we're trying to do. But in some ways, we are a traditional think tank in that we're using research and activating different partners across civil society to try and inform public discourse. But we're not so traditional in the sense that design is our main vehicle for doing so, to really take complicated issues and simplifying them into something super tangible, concrete, and visual to make sure that they're accessible, engaging, and much more action-oriented than a traditional think tank might be focused on.
And why do you think that kind of action-oriented think tank is so necessary right now?
That's a great question. I think there's...
Big one, sorry.
The big one. It's not only about action. I think the key piece here is about optimism. There's a lot already, both when it comes to existing research and reports around what we could do. And I think what we've been missing is a discussion or a debate around what it is that we should do in terms of the thinking about the future of Europe specifically.
I first came across your work when you revealed your Starline project, which is this extraordinarily ambitious blueprint for a new European high-speed rail network. Could you tell us a bit about that project and what exactly it is you're proposing?
Yeah, Starline is a vision for a completely connected high-speed rail network across most of the major cities within Europe. So the easy answer is to say, you know, what if taking a high-speed rail train was the same sort of experience and ease as taking a metro in your local sort of urban capital city? So that's the thinking behind it, and it builds off existing policy and legislation called the TNT, but adds more layers of design when it comes to thinking about elements like user experience and the general experience of making it really desirable and easy to choose a train over planes or cars, for example.
And what's the response been like to Starline? Like, do you think there's actually any chance it could happen?
The reactions to the project so far, there's been a lot of excitement and, you know, people imagining how it might change their commutes or their vacations. But I think there's also been a lot of really interesting feedback, especially when it comes to the map element of Starline. And we've kind of gotten a taste with our first blueprint in terms of what people see as Europe and what Europe means to them and how different that is depending on your own personal backstory. So in that sense, there's been a lot of debate and engagement, particularly around the map.
What was wrong with the map? What was controversial about it?
Ooh, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I think the map was by design provocative. So some of the routes, I think we've gotten a lot of emails from specific engineers of how would you build a route through this particular mountain range?
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of Easter eggs in the map like that, that are non-intuitive routes to kind of place the viewer in the future and say, this is not a plan for tomorrow. This is an ambition that we can choose to buy into for 20, 30, 50 years from now. And who knows what either the, you know, technical world will look like in terms of what's feasible, what will make sense in terms of city location. You know, there's all sorts of what ifs. And the map was kind of designed with that in mind. And that's what's really awoken a lot of debate. And it's been crazy to see that with our first blueprint that people care about, you know, some random new think tank coming out with something. But it's so exciting to see how passionately people are engaging with it.
I noticed also with the visuals you released that the trains are European blue with stars on the front. It's all like pretty deliberately referencing the EU. Has the project had any kind of formal or informal backing from European institutions?
We haven't had any either formal or informal up to the creation of the blueprint. And that's also by design that these blueprints are independent sort of explorations that come out into the world and live their own life. But on the flip side, we've had quite a bit of interest and engagement, both informally and formally, from EU institutions in terms of how to make this real, what are considerations for various, you know, particular technical elements of a, particularly from an experience design perspective. It's been that side, but it's also been, from a lot of private sector actors are specifically involved when it comes to high-speed rail networks. So it's been great to see that there's an interest in how do we make this happen? How do we improve the existing efforts towards this direction?
Your most recent blueprint is something very different, children's playgrounds. Why did you decide to focus on playgrounds? Like, what's lacking in Europe's approach to them at the moment? And why do you see them as so important?
Oh, I love that question. Kova, the other partner in 21st Europe, and I are both parents. So we also have a personal sort of affinity to this, spending a lot of time thinking about playgrounds and being on playgrounds. But something that we really notice from a more topical perspective or a timely perspective is there's so much focus right now in Europe around investing, particularly in defense, and thinking about, you know, war as a critical investment, readjusting a lot of European budgets to align with that discourse. And we felt like there was something missing in terms of if we're investing in defense, what is it that we're defending? Are we still investing in what is worth defending across Europe? And so in that sense, playgrounds kind of became this symbol as, on its surface level, a kind of silly thing to invest in a time of war. And yet it represents so much of what is worth protecting here in Europe in terms of quality of life and our families. And so in that sense, we really liked the timing of it and the tension that was kind of inherent to opening that discussion as well.
I know there are lots of discussions about like how far can we stretch the boundaries of what we can count as defense spending. And some people saying, oh, we should spend defense spending on, like gyms and swimming pools? Do you think we should even, we could argue that by making our playgrounds good, we're making society stronger, and therefore that is defense spending? Or is that ridiculous?
Yeah, maybe that's one approach to it. Yeah. I mean, I definitely think there's a value in terms of, you know, thinking about playgrounds as civic infrastructure and what it means to be a community, to be European, and to be part of something outside of your work or your family life, that there's a unity that can be fostered there that is quite important when you're facing a lot of external threats or crises.
Are there parts of Europe that are really good at building playgrounds already and investing in them? Like, where do you look to for inspiration?
I mean, I'm quite biased based in Copenhagen, Denmark, where I think we have some of the best playgrounds in the world. But one of the interesting things about the playground space here is that the playgrounds are built, or designed rather, with this idea to promote both creativity and exploration, but also social skills and thinking about our children as future citizens. You know, creativity is one of those skills that will be extremely important in the future work market or future labor market. But not just that, but thinking about playgrounds also as an opportunity to develop and invest in critical climate infrastructure. A lot of the playgrounds here in Copenhagen also function as water repositories for floods, are also quite green or have a lot of shaded areas when it comes to heat waves. So thinking about them as sort of multi-purpose spaces, I think is a great step forward when it comes to designing public spaces.
That does sound really amazing. The reason why I asked that question is because we've actually got a mini series coming up called Who Does It Best, in which we're going to be looking at three policy areas: childcare, drug policy, and housing policy. Not playgrounds at the moment, but we're in this process at the moment where we're really looking across the continent to find good examples of policy. And I guess I'm wondering how much your blueprints in general, how much of them come from real world examples that already exist, and how much of it is about like imagining something new?
Yeah, it's a fantastic challenge in terms of the balancing act of anchoring something in the practicalities and realities today, and then stretching the imagination further out into the future and bringing people on that journey. And I would say these past two blueprints, Starline and Continent of Play, and most of the blueprints on our roadmap for the next 2 years are anchored in very real things happening today, whether it's existing projects, existing examples of success, existing policies. And there's something about this connection to today that I think will be a key ingredient to the success of these blueprints moving forward, both in terms of engagement from people, but also in terms of implementation. So it's very much a little bit of both in terms of things that are existing today, but also how do we dial up the level of ambition in terms of what is already in motion today.
Well, I think the plans you've published so far both sound wonderful, but aren't they just things that would be incredibly expensive? Like, how do deal with that?
The golden question. This is actually one of my favorite questions, because I think it's a question that doesn't give us as humans, as Europeans, enough credit in terms of what we've already accomplished. So when we think about, you know, just thinking about major infrastructure projects, past initiatives like the English Channel Tunnel, or between Sweden and Denmark, there's the Öresund Bridge. At the time, they were considered either technically or economically infeasible by a lot of people, and received enormous amounts of criticism. Even the European project itself, in terms of having a shared currency, open borders, you know, all of these things were considered pipe dreams. And they're things that we take for granted today as, yeah, of course we could achieve that. You know, it's here, we're used to it, we live with it. And so I think these things that people think are impossible for whatever reason, whether it's too expensive, unrealistic, technically not possible, I think that doesn't give us enough credit in terms of what we can achieve when we decide that it's a priority.
Thanks to Johanna for taking the time to speak to us. If you would like to hear more about what 21st Europe are doing, check them out on Instagram, 21st.europe, or on their snazzy website, which I'll link to in the show notes. Time to step into the inspiration station and talk about some European culture. What have you been enjoying this week, Wojciech?
Oh, unlike me, I'm always short on recommendations, but this week I have a ton of things to recommend. But I'll go with something that made the biggest impression on me since I last stopped by the inspiration station. So recently, as you know, I got a chance to visit Kosovo. For the first time in my life, even though I've spent quite a bit of time in the Balkans before. Have you ever been there, Dominic?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, so, you know, I just absolutely love traveling in countries that are in transition, you know, like places where things are constantly in motion, there's some transformation or evolution going on. And Kosovo gained independence only in 2008. And it's the youngest country in Europe. And there is even this massive concrete monument in one of the squares that reads newborn, which I find very endearing.
It's very charming.
Yes, it is. So, you know, the country really feels like a newborn with all its pros and cons. There are things to love about it, things to worry about. But I promise if you go there, it won't be a boring trip. I spent most of my time in Pristina, which feels small at a first glance, but when you get the hang of moving around, it magically expands and offers a lot of joys both during the day and after dusk. I took some photos for y'all while I was there, so I posted them on our Instagram. You can go there and have a look if you want to get a sense of how this place looks. And if you decide to go one day, please send me an email at hello@europeanspodcast.com. And I'm going to tell you what is Dua Lipa's most beloved club in Pristina.
Wojciech's Dua Lipa tour of Pristina. Is that your inspiration station?
Yeah, starting from 50 euro a night.
Great. Okay, sign me up.
Okay, what have you been enjoying, Dominic?
I've been reading the book Flesh by David Soloy.
You're such a bookworm recently. You only read books.
I know. I'm so proud of myself. I'm looking at my phone much less. It's really nice.
I'm proud of you too.
Soloy is a Hungarian-British writer who's now based in Austria. The book came out earlier this year and it's already picked up quite a lot of buzz. It's even been longlisted for the Booker Prize and I can see why. It's a big, chunky looking novel. It's about 350 pages, but don't be fooled. It's a surprisingly quick read. A lot of the story unfolds in dialogue, often with the monosyllabic man at the center of the book or with the children in his life. And that sparseness makes it incredibly Moorish, oddly lively, and just very quick to go through because there are hardly any words on the page.
I'm already loving the monosyllabic main protagonist.
Yeah, it's great. He just says okay most of the time.
Okay.
What really stood out for me is the way that Soloy depicts both poverty and extreme wealth and what it does to the same person. He writes about both poverty and wealth in such a straightforward, unshowy way without diminishing the weight or importance. I thought it was really enjoyable and absorbing read. So yeah, go check it out. It's Flesh by David Soloy.
Okay.
Time for a happy ending, and today it comes courtesy of some runaway nuns in Austria.
Let's go.
Three nuns in their 80s, Sister Rita, Sister Regina, and Sister Bernadette, had spent basically their entire lives in a convent just outside Salzburg.
Why there is always Sister Bernadette? There's always one.
It's true. Actually, interesting fact about Bernadette, she joined this convent back in 1948.
Whoa.
Isn't that incredible? But in 2023, someone decided it was time to move these three nuns to a care home against their wishes. Fast forward to this year and they'd had enough. So they did what any good action movie heroes would do. They staged a breakout. They fled the care home and made their way back to the convent, which, by the way, no longer even exists as a proper community for nuns. But with the help of a locksmith and some loyal former students, they got back into their old apartments and are now living there.
Undisturbed.
Well, the provost was not impressed. He said that their move is completely incomprehensible and that the convent isn't set up for their needs.
Incomprehensible. Bernadette stayed there for like 60 years. Now they think she's going to move like that.
More than 60 years, 70.
70, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, well, it does seem like they are staying there, even if the provost is not happy about it. From what the BBC reports, the sisters seem to be doing just fine. The water and electricity are now back on. Doctors have come to check in, and their ex-students are keeping them supplied with food. So basically, they're thriving in their rebellious retirement. And Sister Bernadette had the best line. She said, "Before I die in that old people's home, I would rather go to a meadow and enter eternity that way."
Whoa.
So yeah, three octogenarian nuns pulling off the ultimate jailbreak to live life on their own terms. It's really a proper happy ending for once.
Yeah, I love it. It's very heartwarming.
Someone quickly snap up the film rights.
Oh yeah.
You've got to love a defiant nun.
Bernadette.
That's all we've got time for this week, unfortunately. I think I feel better, actually, after chatting to you for almost an hour, Wojciech. Thank you for helping me get out of my funk.
I don't think it's me. I think it's Sister Bernadette, but you're welcome.
You're probably right. This week's episode was produced by Morgan Childs and Wojciech Oleksiak. We'll be back next week with another episode that I think will come out on Friday. Sorry. So don't be shocked if we're not there in your feeds on Thursday like you would expect.
I'll be pushing everyone to release on Thursday, so we'll see about that.
Oh yeah? Okay. Yeah. Some more discussions need to be had on that.
Yes.
If you'd like to see more of us, come and join us on Mastodon, on Instagram, on Blue Sky, or on YouTube, where you can actually see us doing some talking with our faces. Till next week. Fiati.
Ciao.